Chuck Gallagher was a very successful accountant. He managed trusts and investments, and he'd fly around the country teaching courses on tax. He was, however, living beyond his means and borrowing money from his clients' trusts. It went on for years. Chuck thought he'd be fine, except for that lunch break during a course he was teaching in Boise.
And there was a little pink slip on the door outside that says, "While you were out," and it left the message or the name of my partner, and it said, "Call back to the office ASAP." He said to me, "Chuck, I know you're out in Boise, Idaho. You won't be back, but we received a call from one of your clients that you invested some money for." And as soon as he said that, life as I knew it was over.
Chuck Gallagher talks about how easy it was for him to slip into white-collar crime and how hard he fell when he was caught. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The Justice Department has a new focus on white-collar crime, fraud targeting homeowners. Just 1 week ago, 60 people were arrested in a nationwide crackdown. Over 400 people have been named in the past 4 months. In most cases, crooks are looking for people in financial trouble. They come with these fake offers to help with foreclosure or bankruptcy. Well, we can expect more of this as times get tougher. Those of us who are homeowners are the targets, but the fraud artists are actually the desperate ones. Their own financial houses of cards are falling down, and they're looking for any way to make some quick money. Chuck Gallagher knows that kind of pressure. He was a partner at a CPA firm in Asheville, North Carolina in the mid-80s. He specialized in corporate tax and retirement. He seemed to have it all. He was married, kids, a great job, living what he calls an upper-middle-income lifestyle.
I drove lots of nice cars, whether that was a BMW or a Mercedes, whatever it happened to be, a Jaguar. I was a pilot, flew small airplanes, and actually owned an airplane at the time. So in my mid-30s, I was living in a comfortable environment, four-bedroom home, trading cars every 6 to 9 months, and owned an airplane. I had the trappings of success. I defined success by those trappings. Those people that were successful and had money had some of the same trappings. And so in order to create the illusion that I was just as successful as they were, I wanted to emulate the things that they had.
But if we go back to that time, you were earning close to $250,000 a year, right?
It was probably around $225,000. Yes, it's close to $250,000.
So turn back the pages of your family album here and tell me, what was the moment when you thought, I don't have enough money to make it through this month or at this moment? I don't have enough.
I was sitting in my office, and I received a call from the local banker that held the mortgage on my home, and very nice gentleman. And he called me and he said, "Chuck," he said, "yeah, according to our records, you're 2 months behind in your house payment. And is there a problem?" Now, Dick, the obvious thing is I'm sitting here as tax partner in a CPA firm. The one thing I did not want to do is admit to him that, in fact, yes, I was 2 months behind in my house payment, and there was no way that I was immediately going to be able to catch it up. You know, if I can't manage my money, how are people going to trust me to help them manage theirs? So that was the moment that I realized, you know, it really is a bit out of control. And when that took place, I did the only thing that made sense at the moment. And that was, I said, "Are you sure the payment hasn't been misapplied?" At least with an accounting degree, I knew the right terminology, and I felt like that might throw him off track, at least for a moment, while I could think about what should be the response. And his response back to me was, "Well, I don't think so, but let me go back and check my records. I'll give you a call after lunch." And the choice that I made immediately after that phone call ended was the choice that set my life in an entirely different direction.
You see, Chuck Gallagher was in charge of a number of trust accounts. So after he hung up the phone with his banker, he made the decision to cross that line.
I literally sat there and almost had a conversation with myself. I looked at myself as the trustee and said, "You need some money." And I looked back as the trustee to myself and said, "Well, you know, I could make you a loan." And I went with this dialogue back and forth and eventually typed up this piece of paper, which was really worthless, and stole money from the trust in order to play catch up on those house payments.
How easy was that?
It was simple. It wasn't difficult at all. Under the circumstances, I was completely responsible for the activity of the trust. The client's money went into the trust. I was the one, because of independence, that had the access to the checkbook. And since I did the accounting for it, there was really no internal control to monitor the fact that I had taken money from the trust. And within 3 months, I paid it back.
See, I get that it was technically easy, but morally, as a CPA, as a person whose sole responsibility is to be the person safeguarding someone else's money, how easy was it to cross that line?
I was, at the time, music director in a church. I was a CPA well-respected in the community, but the need was substantial. And once some time elapsed, whether that was 3 months, 9 months, I don't frankly recall, but once some time elapsed and there was no consequence, there was no detection, there was no issue with it, it was cementing the concept that really what I was doing was borrowing money.
The first time you took money, Chuck, you were bailing yourself out of a jam. You couldn't make your mortgage payments. Was there ever a time when you started to take money simply because you wanted to buy something? You wanted a newer, better car, and you thought, this is easy. I can just go back to the trust again.
Absolutely. As time went on, the first time was bailing me out of a financial situation. I believe after that, most of the time, when I went back to a trust or to a client, it was, in fact, to buy bigger, better, flashier, more things. More times than not, what ended up happening was we got into a lifestyle and that created the need for more money. And I don't mean to be flippant in saying this, but you know, you can go into a very nice home and decide, wow, we need window treatments. And it's not an impossible task, at least then, I don't know what it would be today, to spend $20,000 on window treatments, which is cloth hanging from a rod in a room. But it takes a lot of money. It wasn't one thing. It was lots of little things that really created the large illusion.
I'm assuming you didn't talk to anyone else in the office about this.
Oh, absolutely not.
Did you talk to your wife about it?
Absolutely not.
Did you think about that?
Oh, no. Never a thought about it.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Over about 5 years, Chuck Gallagher stole $250,000 from the various trust funds that he managed. He would shift the money around from one account to another, covering anything that looked questionable, creating the illusion that his clients were actually making money, while at the same time he was the one sliding further and further into debt.
I, from time to time, would have the momentary awakenings that this could end very badly. Yet, there was no reason for me to truly believe that because I was in, for all practical purposes, total control. And as a small firm, I don't fault the firm by any stretch of the imagination, but as a small firm, we trusted each other.
But you were more concerned about what one of your partners might notice than you were thinking about the law. You weren't thinking that you were going to get a phone call from the cops.
Nope. Never had the concept that that would take place. Frankly, felt like that as time went on, my income would increase to the point that I would actually pay this back. I was buying time. And with time, I felt that I would be able to get to a place where I had everything I wanted and would have enough money to be able to pay for it.
So tell me about the moment, Chuck, when it all started coming undone.
Oh, it was very simple. I was in Boise, Idaho. I was teaching a tax course. It was a great day. We had a number of participants, CPAs, and I did continuing professional education courses. We broke for lunch, and there was a little pink slip on the door outside that says, "While you are out," and it left the message or the name of my partner, and it said, "Call back to the office ASAP." For a moment, I debated lunch or call back, and I said, "Ah, well, the heck, I'll go ahead and call them back before I grab something to eat." And when I did and got my partner on the line, he said to me, "Chuck, I know you're out in Boise, Idaho. You won't be back for a day or so, but we received a call from one of your clients that you invested some money for." And there was a certain question mark in his voice, but it wasn't an alarm at all. He said, nonetheless, the client called. There's been a financial issue that's taken place, and he needs to liquidate the investment ASAP. And if you'll let me know where the file is, I'll begin the process of getting that taken care of. You know, anything I can do to help you. And as soon as he said that, I knew that life as I knew it was over. There was no chance. I had, by that stage, tapped every resource that I had, and I knew as soon as the call was placed, if this man or this client needed his money within the scope of a week, there would be no way for me to be able to get the funds together. So I told my partner, I said, I know where the funds are invested. It is not something that is easily liquidatable, but I'll go ahead and make a call from here and begin the process. When I get back to the office, we'll sit down and talk about it and go from there. Just give him a call and let him know that I am on top of it, and I will be back with you in the next day or so. And he said, are you sure? I said, absolutely, don't worry about it. And with that, we hung up the telephone.
And did you go back to teaching that tax course?
Absolutely. I have no idea what took place that afternoon, Dick. It was, as far as I'm concerned, it was a dream. I know when the class was over and the participants left, I sat in the hotel room and cried like a baby because there was nothing that I could do. Life had changed, and I knew that it had changed. Soon, my partners, my clients, and my wife would know that it changed.
Chuck Gallagher says at that point he was trying to make sense of just how much his life would change, what the news would mean to family and friends and business colleagues. He wasn't thinking that there was jail time in his future. That would turn out to be another of his miscalculations, and I'll talk with him about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The investigation into mortgage fraud in the U.S. took on another dimension today with news that the Attorney General of Illinois is suing Countrywide Financial and its chief executive, accusing them of defrauding investors by selling loans that they knew were questionable. Just last week, two hedge fund managers at Bear Stearns were arrested.
The government accused these two high-powered Wall Street money managers of being common con men.
The defendants lied about the fund's condition, including their prospects, liquidity, and exposure to the subprime market. They lied in a futile hope that the funds would turn around and that their incomes and reputations would remain intact.
Chuck Gallagher was a tax accountant who stole money from his clients in the hopes that his income and reputation would remain intact. But he was caught. He's with me this hour to give a bit of an insider's look at white-collar crime and punishment. See, Chuck had taken about $250,000 and used much of it to pay the expenses of trying to look like he was a success.
I had worked so hard to create this illusion that now all of a sudden people would find out that, really, I was a liar and a thief. I wasn't the successful person they knew. I wasn't the gregarious person that traveled around the country teaching tax courses. I wasn't all of the things that I had portrayed for so long. I was a liar and a thief. And that was hard for me to accept of myself. And as far as I was concerned, if life ended, that would have been a wonderful escape.
And did you think about that?
Absolutely. That night in the hotel room in Boise, Idaho, I sat there and I contemplated suicide. I didn't know how. I couldn't think of any practical way that would be simple and easy and painless. And around 7 or 7:30, I picked up the yellow pages and began looking for a psychiatrist, psychologist, whatever. I just wanted to find someone to talk to. And I kept getting these recordings. I'm sorry, the office hours from 8:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. And it was becoming very frustrating when the message said, you know, leave a message and we'll be delighted to call you in the morning. And I'm thinking, I may not be here in the morning. This is a waste of time. And I actually got somebody on the line. It rather shocked me, I must admit. And the gentleman told me, whomever it was, I couldn't tell you his name, have no idea who I was talking to, said that he was on his way out the door. I just happened to catch it. He thought it was his wife. He was meeting her for dinner in 15 minutes. And I said, well, I need to talk to you. And he said, call me back in the morning, at which point in time I said, I'm considering suicide. And there was silence. And he said, let's talk. And I don't know how long we talked. It could have been 20 minutes. It could have been 2 hours. But he made a statement to me that was profound. Chuck, you have made a terrible mistake. But you need to hear, you are not a mistake. Every choice has a consequence. But the choices that you make moving forward will define your life and define the lives of your children. And that changed my life.
Did that advice cause you to stop thinking about suicide?
It did. Obviously, I didn't see value in myself because of the choices that I made and the illusion that I created. But yet, I brought two children into the world, two little boys, and the choices that I made moving forward would help define their life. And if there is a reason to make positive choices, that was it.
And so you put the phone down.
Put the phone down, laid in the bedroom. The night passed. I don't recall getting much sleep. Hopped a plane the next day from Boise, Idaho, then to Charlotte, North Carolina, so that I could face my partners and face my wife.
Who'd you see first?
My partners.
And?
When I sat down with them, I called them into the conference room. And I said, we need to talk. And I laid out before them the fact that not only had I not invested this client's money, but I had stolen it. In fact, I had stolen money from other clients. I had stolen upwards of $250,000. And Dick, I believe the night before, one of the things I guess that I was hoping, it was a pipe dream, but I was hoping, was somehow my partners, as angry as they would be, would probably figure out some way to resolve the issue. I don't know. Legitimately borrow money or do whatever it needs to be done to pay off the clients.
To say, Chuck, you're our friend, we'll help you out of this, nobody needs to know, that kind of help?
Yeah, that's probably a thought that I had. Not that it wasn't, you're our friend, I expected them to be pretty ticked off, but I was kind of hoping that perhaps there was a way that money could be paid back, it could be swept under the rug, and no one would be the wiser for it, other than them and I, and that at least it would preserve the ability to live life and to move forward. That didn't take place. He looked at me and he said, I have a solution. You should commit suicide.
He said that to you?
He did. And he said, your insurance is past the 2-year contestability period. You owe these people money. You're a low life for having stolen the money. You really aren't worth anything. That would pay these people back because there's no other way I can see you're going to be able to get the money. And the community will take pity on your wife and children and maybe they will be able to get a fresh start. They deserve better than what you've given them.
Chuck Gallagher's other partner in the firm had a shorter message for him. You're fired. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Chuck then had to go home and face his wife. Now, they'd been married for 10 years. They'd started with nothing and built a comfortable life. They had two children. Chuck wasn't sure how to start.
Dear, I'm not the man you think I am. I've just lost my job. I will lose my license as a CPA, and the things that we own, well, those are mortgaged, and we won't own them. That was probably the hardest thing that I have ever had to do. I can still see the extraordinary disbelief that was on her face.
What did she say?
One, I probably can't repeat everything that she said. It wasn't pleasant. It was our main concern was immediately, probably the same as the partners, is what do we do now? What's the next step? How do we survive? How do our children survive?
You're talking principally about financial survival, right?
Financial survival, how do you get a job whenever you have just admitted you're a liar and a thief? Who would want to employ you? Those are all the types of questions, and especially whenever you're sitting there nurturing the love and care of two children, how does that work?
And then it's how do we tell the rest of our family? How do we tell our friends and neighbors? Emotionally, what was that like for you?
I have to admit, for me, it was easier than it was for my wife. I lived in a small town. A small town, that word is going to get out quickly anyway. So if it's going to get out, I may as well just let it out. I at least released the internal feeling that I somehow would be able to control that. I couldn't control it. So whatever they thought is whatever they thought. The only thing that I could do was make choices that were honest and begin the process of trying to rebuild who is Chuck Gallagher beyond who was this illusion that portrayed himself as Chuck Gallagher.
In figuring out what came next, Chuck caught a break. It started when he told the details of his story to the minister at his church.
Of course, I laid everything out. And he said, "Do you mind if I talk with one of the members of the church?" And I remember the feeling that I had, and not to be flippant, but the feeling that I had was, you can tell anybody you want. It's not going to take long in a small community to get out. There was nothing really to hide. That bothered my wife much more than it bothered me. But the next day, he called me back and he said, "I've talked with this gentleman, and I'd like you to go meet with him Sunday night and share with him what you shared with me." And I did. And 2 days later, he came back and he said, "My wife and I have been looking at house plans. We were thinking about building a new home." And he said, "We went over to look at the house that you and your wife were building. Would you consider allowing us to take that over so that could become our home?" And then he said, "And my son and his wife are expecting, I believe at the time, their second child, and they need a different home. Is it possible for them to look at the home you and your wife are living in?" And within the scope of 1 week, this gentleman had purchased the home that my wife and I were building, and his son purchased the home that my wife and I lived in, as well as the car that I drove, and $500,000 worth of debt was lifted off of our shoulders, which, as far as I'm concerned, was a total miracle.
Was it charity?
I don't think it was charity, Dick. I think it was literally a miracle from God. Once the word really got out and it started to spread, it would become fire sale. I had no leverage financially whatsoever. But here are two people that, just out of the clear blue, what we had met exactly their needs and fell in line to exactly what they were thinking about. Assets that we had that could have resulted in foreclosure and increasing or exacerbating the financial problem that I had created, all of a sudden were unburdened and lifted off of my shoulders. And honestly, the feeling that I had was that all of a sudden there was a point when I decided I would no longer maintain the illusion. I would be honest. And as soon as that took place, it was like different things became apparent. There were different opportunities that presented themselves, at least to make the process tolerable.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Chuck Gallagher's marriage would eventually end, and back at that time, he wound up with a job that paid him $25,000 a year. He still had this big money problem that he'd created for himself and for a number of his clients when he stole from their trusts. Still, Chuck wasn't too worried about being prosecuted.
I told all of the clients what had been done. They were angry, but they wanted their money more than they wanted me imprisoned. So with the help of family and friends, vis-a-vis being able to get a legitimate bank loan with guarantors and so forth, I made restitution to each and every person that I had stolen money from, that restitution plus interest, with the understanding and agreement that they would not seek my prosecution. Fortunately, The local district attorney did not wish to prosecute me. By that point, I had lost all possessions. I had lost my job. I had lost my license as a CPA. And I believe he probably felt like, since restitution had been made, that the consequences had been severe enough. And so there was no local effort to prosecute me at the time.
And at that time, did you think that you would not go to jail, that you wouldn't go to court?
Absolutely. At that time, I felt like that probably the biggest hurdle of the storm, it's almost like the movie The Perfect Storm. I felt like we'd made it past the gales and past the major waves. And while life wasn't easy, it at least was going to continue in a way that would allow me to work and try to put a life back together in some reasonable form. But I had no perception that any sort of criminal prosecution was going to take place.
And when did you find out that, in fact, you would wind up in court?
Probably several months later, I was contacted by two gentlemen. One of them was from the Department of Labor and the other from the Internal Revenue Service. The Department of Labor criminal investigator was interested in prosecuting me for embezzlement from retirement funds, which was clearly a violation of federal law. The IRS criminal investigator, on the other hand, wanted to prosecute me for not paying taxes on stolen money. I got the first one. That one made sense. I never in my wildest dreams, never, ever, ever crossed my mind that I should, on the miscellaneous line of a 1040, list money stolen and pay tax on it.
As far as they're concerned, it's income, though.
Absolutely. It's income from all sources is taxable unless it's specifically exempt. And, gee, I know that. But then again, rationalization said it wasn't theft. It was only a loan or an investment.
How much time did you serve in jail, Chuck?
18 months was the sentence. In federal prison, you typically will serve 85% of your sentence.
So the amount of time behind bars, what, about a year?
Over a year, 16 months. I was physically in federal prison for 11 months. I was in a halfway house for 5 months following that. A halfway house is federal prison. It just gives you a bit more freedom.
And the kind of prison that you were in for white-collar crime, what was that like?
It's a minimum security prison. We get a lot of comments today that, well, you were in club fed. I take a bit of exception to that. It was fed. There was no club about it. Federal prison is federal prison. Most of the people, there were 500 inmates in this particular facility. About 70-plus percent of them were in for drug-related crimes. You got up every day, 5 days a week. You were required to work. I was a garbage man for a period of time. I worked in the business office for about 3 months. Got fired from that job. I'll explain that in a moment. Ended up working out on Air Force base, which is where this facility was housed. Weed eating, cleaning toilets, whatever janitorial duties needed to be done, that's my job when I was an inmate in federal prison. And for that, I was paid 12 cents an hour.
You were fired from a job while in prison?
Yeah, I have to admit, it is a bit humorous. I, thinking to myself, well, gee, I'm a pretty smart guy, I thought, well, you know, with an accounting background, since there is a business office in prison and it is a business, perhaps I should get a job there. It's air conditioned in the summer, heated in the winter, and quite a comfortable environment. So I sought, if I have to work, well, why not get a job there? And so they brought me in. In fact, it was quite comfortable for the person who was responsible for the financial aspects of the prison because he had a whole series of white-collar inmates in there doing all the accounting work. We were there probably for about 3 months or so, and one day the warden walks in, goes back into the financial officer's office, shuts the door. We could hear a rumbling. There were supposed to be soundproof rooms, but you could still tell something was going on behind closed doors. We, of course, all had our head down and we were working very diligently. The warden had just come in. And then the door comes flinging open and he says, "Inmates." We all looked up, give him our complete attention, and he looked across the room and he said, "You're fired." And then proceeded to walk out. And we were all sitting there just in disbelief because we ran the financial office for all practical purposes. And the financial guy came out white as a sheet and he said, "The warden feels that you are not being adequately punished. Your jobs will be reassigned." And Well, the end result was I ended up cleaning toilets in an Air Force facility, and people who were crack dealers who used to work outside, and quite frankly, they liked working outside, were brought into the business office and asked to do accounting longhand. Probably punishment for us both.
Chuck, did you have a prisoner's number?
Yes, I did. 11-642-058.
It was 13 years ago when Chuck Gallagher did his year in federal prison. He says the worst of it while he was there, and the best of it in retrospect, was the time he had to think. Chuck says he spent one Christmas morning lined up with the other inmates, waiting for his 3-minute phone call with his two boys. At the time, they were 8 and 5. And I'll talk about that with the former prisoner, 11-642-058, in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. We are all watching news stories these days about corporate executives who got a little over-enthusiastic lending money in the days leading up to the subprime mortgage crisis. A number of people have been arrested. Some of them will wind up in jail. Chuck Gallagher spent 11 months at the federal prison camp at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. He was a tax accountant who'd been caught stealing money from the trust accounts he'd been asked to manage. Chuck says that he had a lot of time to think while he was in prison, time to think about the successful man that he had been and how his own greed had changed all that. One story that came back to him was an encounter with an old acquaintance in a grocery store.
I had this vision, this past experience kind of come back into my head. And it's really odd, but I remember walking into the grocery store back in the 80s sometime. My wife and I were going to grill out that evening. And so anyway, I walk in and got my steak and shrimp, get to the checkout line. And here is this lady. Her name was Susie. She looks at me as I'm starting to check out. And she says, wow, she says, you're Chuck Gallagher. She said, you don't remember me, do you? We went to high school together. And she said, I've been reading about you in the paper. She said, man, your career has really taken off. You're doing great. I'm so proud of you. I mean, she could not have been a nicer person. On the way out, she said, I hope to see you again. And I'm walking out to the car, swinging my bag of steak and shrimp, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, isn't that weird? Here I am. I'm a CPA, tax partner in a firm. I live in a lovely home, you know. And here this lady is that I went to school with, and she is a checkout chick at the grocery store. That all flooded back to me. It was Christmas morning. She was home with her children. I, on the other hand, at best that day, could stand in line waiting my turn to make a 3-minute collect telephone call to tell Rob and Alex, Merry Christmas. Daddy loves you.
Rob and Alex that year would have been what, 8, 5?
8 and 5, that's correct.
You remember that call?
I do. Here I have two precious children on the other end who want to talk to their daddy, and they want to tell me all about Christmas, and I have to limit what they can say to me, because I only have 3 minutes.
So how'd you do that, with a stopwatch?
No, not to be funny. The inmates behind you would pretty well let you know.
I know, but you'd be talking to Rob and you're thinking to yourself, I got to make time for Alex.
Well, I think at the time, quite frankly, I believe I got both of them on the telephone so that at least they could kind of share back and forth the conversation. And when it got close, I said, guys, Daddy needs to go. I love you. I'll talk to you again. And I could hear the disappointment in their voice, knowing that this was the first Christmas in their lives that I wasn't there. It was different for them and dramatically different for me.
Chuck Gallagher now lives in Texas. He has a job in sales. He's often asked by other people in business to talk about what it is he learned in his rise and fall as a criminal.
Now it's 13 years later, and I am a convicted felon. I am still 11-642-058. I can be looked up in the Bureau of Prisons today. But the reality is, I have been given so many opportunities to be honest, to be candid, and to share the experience that there can be good that comes from some of the worst experiences of people's lives.
So you would agree with me that you're a better person today than the Chuck Gallagher who was stealing money from people, right?
Oh, there's no question about that.
And do you, would you, given a chance to relive the past 15, 20 years, would you go back and do it the same way all over again?
You know, the obvious answer is if I could go back and do it over again, I wouldn't do it. It was dumb. The consequences were horrendous. The pain was incredible. But I can't change that. And now at 2008, I can either be defined by those past choices and therefore always considered a liar, a thief, a convicted felon, somebody that is worth nothing, or I can take the experience and find something that is positive from the experience and hope that perhaps some of the kindness that was showed to me, I can in turn show to others and pay it forward.
And so in this personal redefinition, how hard is it to resist the temptation of a late model car?
Well, that's not a problem at all. I would be the first to admit I like a nice car or a beautiful home or whatever the circumstance may be. But what I know is I don't need it. It's not something that defines who I am. You know, it would be lovely if wealth were not an issue and you could drive whatever you choose. Perhaps I would enjoy driving a sports car, but that's not the circumstance at this point. I drive a comfortable car, a nice Toyota Camry. It's not something that has to define who I am. I am who I am regardless of whether I'm driving a Toyota, a Mercedes, or a Hyundai.
Chuck Gallagher is the senior sales executive for a company that sells prearranged funerals, and he joined me from a studio in Houston. Stories like Chuck's make us all think about choices we make and the consequences that result. If you have a story that involves such choices, or the suggestion of a story we might chase, let me know. You can find me at our website, thestory.org. Just send me a couple of lines, we'll take care of the rest. Or leave me a message on our telephone line at 1-888-962. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. And our next story comes to us from the island state of Hawaii. Robin Sagadraka wrote to me about the curious circumstances involving the memorial service for his mother. It's now a part of family lore. They call it the miracle of the Leis. You see, Robin's mother grew up in Hawaii in the years before the Second World War, and then she married a military man and lived the rest of her life away from Hawaii. Just a few years ago, Robin's mother died. She was living in Virginia, but her final wish was to have her ashes returned to Hawaii and scattered in the ocean.
The following year, we made plans to go out to Lanikai, and we were to stay there for 2 weeks. And at the end of those 2 weeks, we were going to have Mom's memorial service. We enjoyed ourselves immensely, and that's exactly how I think my mother would have liked it. Very idyllic, getting up in the morning to the sound of the waves, you know, eating breakfast, and the kids just rolling out there to the beach, which is literally at the doorstep, mm-hmm. and playing around, and then coming in, they would spend all day, literally all day out on the beach. It was very, very soothing, very soothing time.
So tell me about the memorial.
We held our memorial service. A lot of preparation went into it. We had tents put up. Food was brought in. We had a minister come and preside over the service. And lots of family showed up. Both my mother and my father come from large families, nine kids. each. And so, yeah, we had lots of aunts and uncles and family friends that showed up. Very colorful because everybody, of course, is in Aloha wear. Music playing. We had hula dancing.
I'm going to grow old and die in Hawaii. It sounds like you guys know how to do this.
Yeah, that's your traditional Hawaii gathering there. And, you know, we had a memorial service, a very emotional-filled memorial service when the time came. My nieces and nephews all got up and talked about Baba Chan and what they meant, what she meant to them. She was somebody very much loved by all her grandkids.
Now, how was the weather on that day?
It was actually very nice. It was windy, which happens a lot. It was sunny and pleasant on land, at least.
Oh, this is important too because you've got to scatter the ashes.
Yes.
What's the plan for that?
So my cousin lent us a sport fishing boat, and the idea was we were all going to get on this vessel, journey out beyond the reef, and there we were going to hold this ceremony where we were going to scatter mom's ashes into the water and then throw our leis that we were wearing into the water after her, and then any other flowers that were present were also going to go in the water. And we had this romanticized idea of how that was going to be. We were going to have this idyllic weather, and we were going to very solemnly each going to pass mom's urn between us, and we were going to take a scoop and scatter mom's ashes lovingly into the water one at a time, and then throw our leis lovingly into the water, and they were going to float out with the tide, and that was the peak of the memorial service there.
I'm gathering it didn't turn out that way.
No, quite the opposite. When we got in the boat, there were 19 of us.
A little overcrowded, right?
Yeah, right. And so we push off the dock, and we start journeying out to go around the spit there to the coast where Lanikai is located. And the moment we started heading out there, it became immediately apparent that this was not going to be a smooth journey.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I'm talking with Robin Sagadraka about the plan to scatter his mother's ashes at sea in her home state of Hawaii. It wasn't going that well.
The boat started pitching. It was like being on a very rough roller coaster. And
with
you're
19
not used
people.
To it. With 19 people. That boat is just going at it, and it was just jumping up and down. And I had been on boats before, and I thought I wouldn't be affected. Well, slowly, one by one, all the people on the boat started getting sick, throwing up over the side, and the weather was very gusty, so water and spray and everything would come roaring over the side of the boat. It took us about 2 hours to claw our way out there.
Why did you keep going, Robin? I mean, with everybody throwing up over the side of the boat, even on the day when you want to memorialize your mother, couldn't you say, I think we're far enough?
Yeah. I don't know. That was just the plan, and that we were going to stick to the plan no matter what. I don't know if you've ever been on a moving boat, but when it stops, that's when it gets really bad, because that's when that boat starts getting pitching. You know, at least if you have the forward momentum to sort of like make the boat a little steady. And none of us could stand on the deck. We had to hold on to something. And so now comes time for the actual scattering of the ashes. And I remember seeing my younger brother, Reggie, clawing his way to the back of the boat with my mother's urn going from handhold to handhold. And then he reaches the stern of the boat, and then he unscrews the canister, which is the urn. And he just started reaching into the urn and taking out fistfuls of mom and throwing her over the side. Of course, it being windy, some of it would fly back into the boat, and he would say, okay, this is for Robin, and you throw that, and this is for Reuben, and so on. And after a while, he just upended the canister and just...
And this is for all the rest of us.
That's exactly what it is. And just emptied that thing out right over the side just to get it over with. And we were supposed to all line up at the stern of the boat and then throw our leis lovingly into the water after the ashes. But what we ended up doing was we just took our leis off and we frisbeed them over the side. One of us would say something like, here, Mom, this is for you, and throw this thing over the side. The finale came when my niece started dragging out onto the deck this huge bag. It was a big garbage bag full of flowers and leis that my aunts and uncles had contributed to the ceremony.
These were all the aunts and uncles who were waiting on shore for you, right?
Yes.
Okay.
The lucky ones waiting on shore. What she ended up doing was ripping that bag open, then upending it over the side and shaking it out, taking all the flowers out.
There is no ceremony in any of this. It's just like, get it done so we can go home.
It was like a scene from Deadliest Catch. And you see those waves coming over the side. And we said, okay, now let's get out of here. And I tell you, there was no sight greater, better than that dock. So we all got off that thing and got off the boat. And the moment we got off the boat, I felt absolutely fine. You know, it was just being on firm ground did it for me.
What were you thinking that evening, Robin, when you finally got terra firma underneath you and you had a chance to dry off? Were you thinking to yourself, darn, you know, that all that planning that went into that celebration of Mom's life, that handing the urn of ashes, that was all lost. Were you thinking that you'd missed something, that you'd lost something?
Not exactly. All the guests had gone. We thought we would be back in time to still enjoy the festivities, but of course, everybody had gone by then. Several of my uncles remained behind, and they told us that they saw us out beyond the reef being tossed around, and they were just wondering how was the voyage, and they thought it was absolutely funny. And, you know, we all laughed about it. We can laugh about things like that when you're not in the middle of it.
Was there anyone saying this was the revenge of Baba Chan or anything like that?
Well, many of us remarked that Mom, who had a great sense of humor, probably incited this as one last joke on all of us. You know,
you won't forget me.
Exactly.
I'm talking with Robin Sagadraka about the final farewell for his mother. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. And Robin's story has a quite unexpected ending. Here it is.
The next morning, my niece went out to the beach, and then she came running in back into the house, and she was telling us something wonderful had happened and that we should all go out and see. And so we took ourselves out to the beach, and there, right in front of our beach house, were all the flowers and leis that we threw overboard the previous day. They had all, I don't know how it could possibly have happened, because we were so far out to sea and there was winds and currents going everywhere, but all the flowers that we had thrown overboard, the leis, had washed up onto the beach right in front of our house.
Not along the rest of the beach?
No, only in front of the, directly in front of our house. I walked about 100 yards down both sides of the beach to see if any more flowers had washed ashore at other places, and I couldn't find any. They were all concentrated right in front of our house. In fact, the lei that had been adorning my mother's urn at the memorial service was actually propped up on a rock because it was low tide, right in front of our house.
But mm-hmm. What are you saying to each other?
Well, I recall standing there looking at all this and just in jaw-dropping amazement because it was very clear that most of the flowers, if not all the flowers, were directly in front of our house. And we knew it was the flowers from the memorial service, because you don't get the hundreds of flowers and leis washing up on the shore every day. And we all looked around and we all sort of said to ourselves, this is Mom. This is Mom, you know, this is Mom's last aloha to us.
This is a great story, and you call it, you have a name for it, right?
Right. In my family, we call this the miracle of the leis, and that's how it's been retold.
That's such a great way to have that memory of your mother. I mean, if the last time you saw her, she was ill and you know, mm-hmm. not well, to have the flower story as her final story.
And you know, since you mentioned it, her illness, like I said, was very aggressive, and she was very she was in a lot of pain. So that tragic image was sort of alleviated now by this wonderful gift that she gave us.
Robin Sagadraka got in touch with us to let me know about this story, and I don't know, maybe it reminds you of a favorite story from your family, one that you'd like to share. If you've got a thought about that, leave me a note at our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.